Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Bring in show music, please.
Hi, I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on Squawk Pod, Steve Eisman, the Big Short investor at Neuberger Berman, says the economy is fine and a rate cut just doesn't make sense.
My actual fear is that if the Fed were actually to cut rates, the market becomes, I guess, bubblicious, and then we have a real problem.
And making it work with a four-day week. Exo CEO Sarah Robb O'Hagan on experimenting with less time in the office.
The business performed better. The managers said that their employees held their performance levels. And most importantly, the employees, people are just significantly feeling better.
Plus, the never-ending Disney proxy battle.
Like some of our presidential elections, you might not actually get an answer tomorrow night.
Hanging chads.
And shares of DJT. Trump media stock jumped and then stumbled.
When people talk about the credibility of the markets and manipulation and what the SEC is trying to look for, this is like the ultimate manipulated stock.
Well, who's manipulating it?
Well, that's what's so interesting about it. I don't know.
It's Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1. Cue, please.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. We are live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Yesterday was a little bit of a difficult day for the markets. Here's how the major averages kicked off that second quarter. Dow, by the end of the session, was down by 240 points. The S&P was down by 0.2%, and the NASDAQ was up just slightly, up by about 0.1%. The Treasury market was pretty interesting, too. You had ISM manufacturing numbers that came out that were actually showing growth for the first time in about a year and a half. You would think that's good news, but what it did do is push back expectations for rate cuts. You can see the 10-year this morning's at 4.33, the 2 years at 4.71. You did see yields move up to the highest levels they've been at in a couple of weeks. And I think there was about a 14 basis point move for the 2 year and a 10 basis points move for the 10 year on that manufacturing data, which really came as a bit of a surprise.
Well, that's like 434, right. Basically, right?
Yeah.
Or no, yeah,
433. Yeah.
What, 0.9? So it was 420 yesterday.
Yeah. So it was 14 basis points that it moved, and it was basically just on that stronger than expected ISM manufacturing. You add that together with the higher inflation data, with the PCE numbers that came out on Friday, right. The comments from Jay Powell and Christopher Waller last week, too, right. And all of it kind of has people thinking that June rate cut may not happen. I think actually Fed futures fell below
Roger Ferguson said it over and over again, yeah. And he's been our accurate barometer about all of it.
Well, we were at 6. And then it was like, well, would you settle for 5? Okay, 5. How about 4? Well, 4 would be good. And then we decide, okay, we're going to do 3. Jay Powell says 3, but it could be 1 or 2. And now 3 is suspect. Now, yeah. I mean, one is like kissing your sister,
but
right?
By the way, we're in Jamie Dimon camp. He said this. And yeah, everyone said that he was crazy. And
but the crazy thing he's saying is that it's going to cause the Fed to stay higher for longer to cause a recession.
Because of stronger than anticipated?
It's like a really, sure. It's kind inflation. Of a perverse call. It's like, yeah, the economy is going to be so strong that we have a recession.
But I think Jamie Dimon's point also is that inflation's going to run strong.
Right.
That's what it's going to be. It's going to be that there a replay, not exactly of years ago, but where inflation doesn't come, right. It isn't transitory. You got to stay high, maybe even raise again. I've been thinking, I mean, we can't guarantee. Like when we talk about, we'd argue with analysts, is the market going to be up 5%, 10%, 20%? What if it was down 5%? We know, sometimes we don't even talk about that. I think it's possible that they raise rates.
It's possible, I think. But you're also talking about the S&P that performed up 10% for the first quarter, best first quarter that they've
seen. Right, but just in general, that's our attitude. Yeah. It's like, well, what do you think? Up 5, up 10, up 20?
Right.
We never even talk about down. Could be.
Talking about up, down, let's talk about this vote, which is happening literally as we speak this week. Disney pulling ahead now in its proxy battle against Nelson Peltz, with more than half of all shares voted on. That's according to the Wall Street Journal, citing people familiar with the matter. It said that BlackRock, Disney's second largest shareholder, is among the big investors backing Disney. Another major shareholder, T. Rowe Price, saying yesterday that it plans to support Disney as well. Investors still casting votes, so this is not over yet, and can change them also through the annual meeting, which takes place tomorrow. And of course, you know, you have a certain count now. You have, it's possible, and there are folks out there, including Ken Shire and others who've been with us, who think that, like some of our presidential elections, you might not actually get an answer tomorrow night.
Yeah.
And that this could go on for weeks. There could be efforts to do recounts. I mean, we could be into
hanging chads.
We could be into that kind of scenario. So we'll see.
I think they got a couple of the big institutional investors right. yesterday, and that's kind of what they were hanging their right. hat on, some of these things, Blackstone and others. Now, all of these votes could also be changed up through tomorrow's meeting. So that adds to the uncertainty.
I don't think the big guys are going to be changing their views so quickly, but nonetheless.
It's kind of interesting. The you think about wage gains, and you have to measure wage gains with inflation. Well, what about when the CMS gives you an increase in Medicare and Medicaid services, and it doesn't really go up much in a big inflationary environment? You don't have as much, yeah. right? That's why the shares of health insurers are tumbling across the board, and they did yesterday. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services finalized next year's, the 2025 rate announcement for Medicare Advantage and prescription drug coverage, and the final rate of a 3.9% increase, 3.7, is unchanged from the earlier proposal in January. Disappointing analysts who were expecting a bump up from that. Analysts say that the rate increase is a de facto cut after you account for the rising costs of labor, drugs, and medical services, and all the stuff we talk about with inflation, and also new price caps on out-of-pocket spending on prescription drugs that was introduced in the Inflation Reduction Act. And when we first saw yesterday, we were up 100 points, remember, on the Dow? And then suddenly it was down by the end of Squawk Box. And we showed a list of Dow components.
United Health
was the one that was really down. Yeah.
Really interesting to think about this and the implications, because kind of the bad news on this is, if you think it's good news for you on the insurance front, what I will say is insurance plans always have a way of getting the money back. You know, they weaken right. the benefits. They find other ways of coming at
they
it.
Keep their medical yeah. loss ratio up yeah. as high as they can. You would think, you know, we do need to probably, you know, try to cut down on healthcare inflation, mm-hmm. right? And that's the biggest provider, CMS.
Yeah, I think Buffett always calls it the tapeworm that is eating up more and more of a portion of the budget and the outlays that we're putting up.
Right. USA Today, we all want to live to 100. All of us want to live to 100.
Yep.
Yeah.
What's that going to cost? What's the cost of everyone living to 100? That's a minimum for what I'm thinking. You know what I mean? Especially when, with the sort of cyborg type capabilities, which are coming, aren't they? We already got some of them. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm going to be like part machine.
The part Terminator?
Hoping. Hoping. That your worst nightmare. Ever think about that when I'm over here at 100. You'll be a geezer by then.
Not a thought I want to
entertain. We'll be co-geezers. Because you forget, we are contemporaries. It's like, you know, like years ago when these the two great giants in literature, they can be 30 years apart. And one can feel young and, oh, I'm going to live. But they're really contemporaries, Andrew. So that's, I want you to think that way. All right? Not boomer versus, you know, hip Gen Zer.
Shares of Trump Media falling 21.5% just yesterday. This after the company reported a net loss of $58 million in 2023. So we're finally getting some of those numbers now on revenue of just $4.1 million. So think about that. I mean, think about
what it was worth
underneath this company. The company disclosed that it nearly ran out of cash last year and would have struggled to survive without the recent deal that took it public. So it wouldn't have even existed. In a filing, the company said it expects to incur operating losses for the foreseeable future. And it warned shareholders that former President Trump's involvement in the company could put it at greater risk than other social media companies. Trump owns 53.5%. 57.3% of Trump Media shares, a stake worth about $3.8 billion as of yesterday's close. It's about $1 billion less than it was. The stock hit a high of $79.38 last week. That was shortly after going public via SPAC. But, you know, he still has to get permission from the board of the company to either sell his shares in the next 6 months or to even take a loan out against them.
Right.
Otherwise, all this is paper money and irrelevant. And then there's this sort of memification of this stock, clearly, which if you look at the underlying numbers, there is sort of
no way. Think of what happens to most SPACs.
To get there.
Pick your SPAC. And a lot of them are down 90%.
And do you think then in this case, like the Diamond Hands folks who said they were in forever and they didn't care. They were trying to stick it to the man. It wasn't really about making money. Is that what this is?
I think this is a different type of meme stock.
Sure, but I'm saying, do these people, whoever's doing this, do they understand that they're likely to lose their shirt, and is losing their shirt okay for them because they're funneling money from one? I mean, basically, you have to think to yourself, you're basically funneling money from one person to another to exact a election outcome, right?
But
that's sort of what's happening.
They're trying to influence the election, but also it's a bet on the election. Because if he were to win and uses Truth Social as his main social media, think of what used to happen with Twitter when just media coverage in general. There are cable news networks that exist because of Trump. Almost not exist, but the ratings on certain years were so much higher. So it's kind of a bet on the election, which who knows at this point.
Oh, so you actually think that there's an underlying business? If he's the president, there's a better underlying business?
Yes.
Okay, I'll take the other side of that.
But once again, they even warn, whenever you read the risk profile of a company.
There's no way to justify anything even remotely.
No, but that does it. It's not alone in that regard in the SPAC world. I mean, remember the meme stock craze? None of those companies
This is actually, I would argue, even in a different league than the SPACs, meaning, given how terrible the underlying businesses of the SPACs were relative to this, this is a meaningfully bad business. I hate to say
it. It was a shocker when it came out and went to 79. It was kind of a shock.
What's a shocker? It's a 46.
Based on any normal, what was the revenue? What would you say it was? You said the revenue was like,
In the millions. Yeah, $4 million.
And they won't release their daily average users or their monthly average users, which is a point of consternation.
There's no doubt.
I mean, $4 million.
Right.
And the company is worth, I'm just saying.
It's probably 1,000 times sales.
Right. That's what I'm saying. I don't think there's an underlying business even there in a good, even if people got this, the outcome that they wanted.
You mean if he was elected president again?
Correct.
Probably still not going to be a...
You're not going to get $46.90 for your money ever.
I don't see it replacing X anytime soon.
And that's the point.
I very, very rarely use it.
But that's the point, that it's just such a...
You ever been on it? I've never been on it.
No, what strikes me, though, about this, and this is the thing I don't understand about the SEC.
More social networks
this, to me, when people talk about the credibility of the markets and manipulation... Right, and what the SEC is trying to look for this is like the ultimate manipulated stock.
Well, who's manipulating it?
Well, that's what's so interesting about it. I don't know. I mean, I don't know who the people are who've decided that they are betting on this.
But I think there's a lot of situations in the market where it's like save them from themselves and things that you think are going to be a bad bet. And that's what a market is for,
don't need to look far to find 100 SPACs that are down 99%. So every single one of them, you could say there was no underlying business from the very beginning. Every one of them. And when was GME really worth $400?
Or you can even look at the internet bubble when we had all those stupid companies that went out, the pet socks and the
I don't know.
Some people think...
I'm not defending it. I'm just saying
some people think Tesla is a...
Tesla's got an underlying business.
It has a great underlying business, but you can have people come on here and say it's a giant government subsidized Ponzi scheme. People have said that. I see it on Twitter all the time. I don't believe that.
Next on Squawk Pod, to cut or not to cut interest rates. The great debate for the Federal Reserve with Steve Eisman, the investor immortalized in The Big Short. He says, nothing to see here.
Things are good. The Fed should do nothing and wait for data to get weak, because there's no weak data.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You're listening to Squawk Pod.
Stand by, Joe. His mic, Q.
Good morning and welcome back to Squawk Box here on CNBC, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Joe Kernan, along with Becky Quick and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Joining us now with his view on the Fed and the central bank's market impact, Steve Eisman, senior portfolio manager at Neuberger Berman. And we've had you on enough that I'm always a little bit hesitant to try to ask you for big picture, top-down analysis, because a lot of times you don't really want to go there.
I actually have an opinion on this one.
Good. You have an opinion on this, but I'll just start by saying we're in kind of an interesting environment where we're definitely worried that the economy, for Fed reasons and for Fed cut reasons, we're worried that the economy is staying strong and that inflation
is... I think it's more than staying strong. I think there's been a reacceleration.
But we're also worried... Right. That there's going to be a recession because the Fed is going to have to engender one. So we're worried about the economy's too strong and there might be a recession.
So everybody's hoping for a little bear's porridge.
Exactly.
Right.
Something just right. Because
right.
We're worried. And has that ever happened? Can we really orchestrate that?
Yeah, we have it right now. Everybody should just relax.
is that your view right now?
No, my view is I feel that ever since Greenspan was in charge of the Fed has always been extremely insensitive to its own impact on markets. And, you know, when Powell said, I think it was last week, it feels like an eternity ago, that financial conditions are tight, I was like, what planet are you on? So, I mean, my view is the economy's fine. There should be, I personally think there should be no Fed cuts this year. And, you know, the market will do whatever the market does, but the economy is fine. Why would you cut? You know, my actual fear is that if the Fed were actually to cut rates, the market goes into some, it becomes, I guess, bubblicious. And then we have a real problem. So, you know, things are good. The Fed should do nothing and wait for data to get weak.
Because
there's no weak data.
We still argue about, do you look at rates in absolute terms, or do you look at them as,
you know, that debate bores me.
But in absolute
right.
terms,
it really does.
They're not in absolute terms.
They're not high.
They're up 500 basis points.
So what? Has anything bad happened? Nothing bad.
No, that's
happened.
What I mean. I remember 7 and 8% and businesses did just
right.
fine.
So the economy is good. I actually think, like I said, it's reaccelerated somewhat. Why would you? On what basis would you cut?
Some
rates?
People think that the shock of 500 basis points is dislocated.
They've been talking about that shock for the last 2 years, and the economy stays fine.
So what's causing the Fed to talk about 6 rate cuts 6 months ago?
My personal opinion is I think Powell is deep down is just a dove. He's always been a dove. He, you know, raising rates was out of character for him. He had to do it. And he wants to cut rates. But I at this point, you know, not that anybody ever calls me, but, you know, I would just do nothing. You know, why would you do something when the economy is fine?
You don't think we need to raise?
No, I don't. But actually, my fear is that if they cut,
that we'll
actually have to raise. That would be the worst possible thing that could possibly happen. So, you know, one of the things I've learned as a portfolio manager is one of the maybe the hardest thing to do as a PM is to do nothing. because it's so easy to actually do something. And it's the same thing with the Fed. It's so easy to do something. They could cut whenever they want to cut. The hardest thing to do is just to sit back and say, okay, everything's fine. Let's just sit and wait. And if things get a little weak, then we can cut.
You don't think there's, you said bubblicious. We're not, are we pre-bubblicious yet? I mean, we're getting it.
Look, the market, but the fundamentals are really good. You know, one thing I always think about is, you know, 1999, 2000, when the market definitely was in a bubble. But what killed the bubble was not that it was a bubble. What killed the bubble was that the Fed raised rates a lot and put the economy into recession. It was the recession that killed the bubble, not that it was just
so
per se a bubble.
So what do you think is driving this economy, though? Is it new productivity gains that somehow AI is coming that's getting
really
exciting?
I think the two big things that are happening right now.
Just a lot of liquidity? What's the...
No, I don't think it's the liquidity per se. I think it's real fundamental is that there's real AI, there's real investing, and there's tremendous amount of money being spent on infrastructure. And there's still a shortage of jobs, so the consumer is fine. It's a nice, you know, it is a little bear's porridge in a way. So why would you spoil it by raising rates, by lowering rates?
But just going back to like 2000, like the idea of a bubblicious situation at that point, you said it was the Fed raising rates that made it. I mean, the Fed raised rates and then made business models where you were making no profits.
Right, but today the companies that people talk about are real companies that have real revenue, that have real earnings. I mean, look, NVIDIA's earnings have tripled.
But I'm just saying that right. It wasn't necessarily the Fed just raising rates. The Fed raised rates, and then it was...
No, but then the economy actually went into recession, and the speculation went out of the market.
Can I ask a question that may seem political? We are in an election year.
Yes.
And depending on the political channel you watch, you might be told that the economy is terrible and that folks are spending, you know, inflation is run away.
Right.
Costs of everything are up. Everything is, you know, the sky's falling.
Right.
And then I'm hearing you, as someone who's in the markets, say the economy is great and that this is actually like a Goldilocks
Please
moment.
Don't say that word, Goldilocks. It's very, okay. I'm very sensitive.
Whatever you want to call it.
Little bear.
Larry Kudlow used to talk about that. He used to drive me nuts.
Whatever you think this sort of moment is, and I'm hoping that you can square the circle, if you will, of how these two ideas could exist, unless you just believe that one.
Say the Biden economy is great and it's not getting credit. It's really where we head with many guests.
But it's fair. It doesn't get credit. I mean, look, the unemployment is really low. Wages are still going up.
Wages are just finally going up.
Right, for the last few years.
They're below, people's spendable income is still below where it was when he took office.
That's
average
fair,
week.
But the trend is up.
It has been,
and right. You know, people still have savings. You know, the only thing negative you could say is that there's been inflation, so some things are harder to buy and harder to buy.
But, yeah, a little bit, 30%.
But okay,
total.
That's fair. But inflation is starting to come down, or
yeah,
at least it's flattened out.
The rate of increase is coming down.
Right. Okay, but you know,
so
wages are still going up. All I can tell you is that
you're calling for deflation, which would be worse.
I'm not calling for it.
Nobody
wants that. But the price increases are in, and for everything.
That's fair. But the only thing I would just say is that there's no sign that the economy is weakening.
Right.
There are signs that the economy is getting a little stronger.
But if you're living on, you know, if you're not lucky and you're not like us, you go to the grocery store and you're buying less than you did 3 years ago.
Okay, maybe, but still things are still pretty good overall.
For us, things are pretty good.
No, for most of the people in the country, things are pretty good.
Why would it be good for most of the people in the country if they can buy less than it was 3 years ago?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. Wages are still going up. People are employed. There's a shortage of labor.
They're finally going up, but they're not back to where they were in real dollars 3 years ago.
Okay, so you can't have everything.
Okay, good. Let them eat cake.
Cheese will be next.
Coming up, Google plans to destroy web browsing data that you maybe didn't realize was being collected.
Total BS. It was never. What does incognito mean?
And new research into a shorter work week. Entrepreneur and former Flywheel CEO Sarah Robb O'Hagan on Clocking Out.
You're working 4 days a week. What's going to happen to you later this week?
I'm going to do you Friday.
More Squawk Pod still to come.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
You're listening to Squawk Pod. Here's Andrew Ross Sorkin.
Google planning to destroy a trove of data. This of millions of users' web browsing's history. It's part of a settlement in the class action lawsuit that accused Google of misleading users about how its browser had tracked the activity of anyone who used the private, Joe, you know about this, the private incognito mode. Specifically, the suit claimed that Google's marketing and privacy disclosures didn't inform folks properly that some data was being collected, including details about which websites viewed.
Great.
Right here. Spokesman said the company is happy to delete old technical data. He said the track data was never associated with an individual or used for any form of personalization or sent to any wives. No, that's a joke. The settlement didn't include. Nobody laughed. The settlement did.
You're on your own on that one.
Yeah,
sorry.
I was trying to keep it away. Yeah, you're trying
to keep this thing going
There's a term in psychiatry called transference. I don't know whether you've heard of it, but that's where you start blaming the.
The settlement didn't include any damages, but it does allow for individuals to file claims. Plaintiffs were originally seeking $5,000 in damages per user.
Okay, here's my question on
this.
They destroy the data because they weren't appropriately and properly advising you that they were doing this tracking. Do they now change what they say in the crazy long statements that they flash at people?
That's a good question. I don't know
keep tracking it from here on out.
I don't know the answer. I think actually they don't track it from here on out is what
that
I recall reading, but I could be wrong about this.
While you were out, we got into a little bit of the idea of what car companies are now tracking.
Right.
In terms of the data that they follow. There was a great piece in the New York Times that followed through. We spoke with the writer of that piece, the journalist behind it. The car company keeps flashing up. By the way, we're tracking your information. There's no way to turn it off in my stupid car. So it's becoming, and we had a lot of people who kind of have weighed in.
And the information's being shared with the insurance companies.
Well, the problem is it's being shared with third parties who then share it with insurance companies who know potentially, or it's happened. She tracked down a lot of people who got burned by this, who their insurance rates went up, or they couldn't get access to
it. It would just be a higher than average speed. It doesn't measure if you roll through a stop sign.
No, it does. And it knows if you brake sharp.
It knows if you roll through a stop.
Or if you accelerate really quickly. Like, that was the level of detail that they were tracking in these things.
Is it out of the ordinary acceleration, or what if you always accelerate?
That's one of the people she spoke with in the article. The guy said, "I don't think I accelerate quickly.
Right.
I don't think I brake quickly.
I do it all the time, so it doesn't. It's not out of. I've never got any. No one's ever said anything.
Well, maybe your car isn't tracking.
No, every time I get in my car, it says something about a report.
Privacy thing, right? Just so you know, we're tracking.
And I just hit the X as quick, to get through.
I tried to turn it off. You can't turn it off very easily. You can turn it off, but it will then disable your GPS. It will disable the ability to have the connect with the thing, which I'm kind of okay with that. I'm not sure if it disables your satellite radio.
I'm back on this incognito. So
yes,
that's total BS. It was never
incognito.
What does incognito mean?
But Google says that they weren't tracking it to individual people.
It wasn't being tracked to you.
That's the difference.
Okay. And it wasn't showing up in your search history. So in case somebody was looking through your search history,
But the question is, do you ever keep that data completely separate? AT&T is now in this hot water over the idea that their files got stolen with people's social security numbers. I don't even know why a phone company.
But the bigger issue was the cooking, meaning the cookies. There were no cookies. So if you're going from one site.
What are those things?
Well, here's a good example, though, Joe.
Yeah.
If you were in your incognito mode.
Yeah.
In your regular mode.
Right.
Regular mode.
Yeah.
And you go from you go from the Drudge Report.
Yeah.
To another website.
They know
and
where
they go
you just
from
came
that
from.
Website to the Wall Street Journal and the Wall Street Journal back to another site. They know all the different sites that you've invariably gone to.
Right.
I don't know how you feel about that.
I think Drudge is some of the most damaging porn on the internet right now. I do.
It's no longer your homepage?
I'm sorry? No. Drudge is definitely
it's
political porn. Oh, my God. It's just insufferable. I know. I try not to look at it, but then I don't see the Florida Man stuff.
So where do you go?
I want to see Florida Man stuff. I saw one yesterday. Do you see that?
No.
Emergency landing poop was oozing out of the bathroom on the plane into the aisles. They had emergency. Oh. You didn't see that?
No, I missed it. I'll go look.
I was on Drudge. I'll send it to you.
Okay.
I sent it to my family.
I don't like missing.
So what have you moved? Have you Babylon Bee is now the homepage? What's the
Babylon Bee could be the homepage. Well, Babylon Bee, I thought about reposting a couple of them. I think I could get canceled for something that they.
I think you could.
Because they are out there now. They're saying stuff.
I would hold your fingers back. Companies have been experimenting with four-day work weeks to boost productivity and reduce burnout. At performance coaching company Exos, over the past year, employees worked 4 days with a you-do-you day. How about that, Joe? You want to do a you-do-you day?
No.
Yes, you do. Since the change, its sales pipeline surged. Employees say they're more productive. And joining us right now, first on CNBC, is Sarah Robb O'Hagan, Exos CEO. You're working 4 days a week. What about what's going to happen for you later this week?
I'm going to do You Do You Friday.
And what happens on a You Do You Friday?
So it's called You Do You for a reason. So actually, about 70% of our employees did do work on a Friday, but it was quiet, thoughtful work, right? So they're able to clear the decks, have a great weekend, come back refreshed on Monday.
And have you found any downside to this whole situation? And how much of this is about four days versus also in office versus out of office? Because it's the other component part of the situation.
It's a great question. I mean, the whole thing, we did a study on this, right? We partnered with Wharton, so we have real data to back it up. The business performed better. The managers said that their employees held their performance levels at the same level that they were before the study. And most importantly, the employees. We had beforehand 70% had experienced burnout. Now it's 35. Like, people are just significantly feeling better. So I don't really see a downside.
But is it you get to work out of office if you're doing work? Like, nobody comes in. That's the...
Yeah, so we are a very dispersed workforce, right? So we have employees who are out in sites at our client. We have 25% of the Fortune 100 are clients. So people are everywhere. So depending on who the client is how they structure their... what we call their recovery readiness week. So there's the four-day work week, but also all throughout the day. Like, we are really strict on you have to have breaks throughout the day. You are not allowed to be on a Zoom for an hour and a half staring at a screen without having a little break.
How applicable, though, is this to every company? You're on the board, for example, of JetBlue.
Yes.
I mean, they run 24 hours a day, seven days a week. Can you actually run a company like that in this kind of way?
It's a really great question. We get that from a lot of clients. And honestly, it's about how you structure, like, overall recovery for that particular environment. So,
like, what about us? We have to be on for 5 days a week.
You do, unless you said, well, how do we, what about if we rotate it? Like,
we'll make do.
We'll
you can do. I mean, what would you settle for? Would you want them here at least one day, right?
One day a week. But it does raise the question of the have and have nots. There's a lot of jobs you can't do. Yeah. Whether you be a restaurant worker and they're talking about higher pay for these areas, it's great that you can find ways to not have your workers burned out, but the inequality measures really shoot up.
Totally agree with that. But if you think about restaurant workers as an example, like, you could stagger schedules. So it doesn't have to be everyone taking the same day off. Or you may say, we can't do a four-day work week, but we can do recovery breaks. We can figure out how to build some kind of recovery into the day.
What do you say to the CEOs who run Wall Street banks in America who say that part of the ethos of their business is a culture of apprenticeship?
Yes.
And that they have to build a relationship culture. So that actually, if you have people who are traveling anyway, two or 3 days a week, you actually need everybody to be there. So when the folks actually are there, there's other people to effectively mingle with, for lack of a better word. And if they're not there, you can't build that culture.
Yeah, totally agree with that, by the way, because one of the things we're studying a lot right now is the impact of community on mental health. Like, that's a huge issue too. So there's the apprenticeship thing, and then there's the I feel great. Like, young people are really struggling. But you can, again, schedule. Like, how do you think about not just every week, but quarterly? Like, bringing teams together for really distinct scrums, like making sure everyone's in the same place, because you do have to have the in-person connection. We really believe in that.
Sarah, it's great to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
That's Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for listening. On our rundown tomorrow, New York Mets owner Stephen Cohen in his first CNBC interview ever. He's the hedge fund manager who paid a nearly $2 billion fine for insider trading at his former firm. Now he's an early stage investor, a big league owner. He's gotten involved in meme stocks. You don't want to miss this interview. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
All of us want to live to 100.
Yep.
Yeah.
What's that going to cost?
And all three will live forever.
We'll be co-geezers.
Tune in on TV weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern and get the best of our show when you follow Squawk Pod. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.